Hello.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Thank you so much for calling. It's so great to talk to you on here.
My pleasure. My distinct pleasure. So where are you calling from?
We are calling from KURE 88.5 Ames Alternative in Ames, Iowa. And my name is Samantha Bias, by the way.
Excellent, Samantha. Let's see. What's it like in Ames, Iowa? I feel like I've only been to Iowa City.
It's cold and it's windy. Yeah, it's,
well, that's something,
it's pretty much
something
it.
We have in common.
So where are you calling from?
I'm in the Sullivan County in the Catskills, what was formerly known as the Borscht Belt, famous for the birthplace of stand-up comedy, I'm just about 5 minutes from Bethel, New York, where the Woodstock Festival happened.
That's awesome. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's okay. it's a very quiet part of the world. It's very nice.
I was wondering, could I have you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Of course. My name is John Flansburgh. I'm the guy with the glasses in They Might Be Giants.
Cool, thank you. So I was wondering, just to kick us off, could I have you, just for the listeners that don't know, describe your sound for us? It's like your band's sound in general.
Sure. Well, when I first, when I get into a taxi cab in New York and I'm carrying a guitar, for years and years, you know, like the first thing that the taxi driver will ask you is like, you know, you're in a band? And I would say, yeah, I'm in an alternative rock band. And then he's like, what does that mean? And it's like, well, you know, it's like rock music, but it's not, you know, like Rod Stewart. It's like kind of different. We play in a lot of colleges. He's like, oh yeah, college, get it. And then they'll say like, you know, like what kind of songs do you do? And I'll say like, it's like, they're like the Beatles, but like with like a kind of, more unusual words. That is my exact description of They Might Be Giants.
I think that was a really good description of it. Yeah, I am like a lifelong fan of you guys, and so I think that's kind of good, just like eclectic, kind of weird Beatles-y music. Yeah, like I have literally been listening to you like my entire life. My dad introduced me to you guys when I was probably 3 years old or younger, and I have been like kind of a devoted listener since. It's like, it's really, really great to talk to you about this stuff.
That's interesting. So what I'm curious, like what other, I mean, obviously, you know, parents can have like a really profound influence over their kids' musical taste, but like what other, like what's your current, you know, what band are you like raving about right now?
Just
out of my own curiosity.
I listen to a lot of like garage rock. Ty Siegel, if you're familiar with him.
I love Ty Siegel.
Really?
Yeah. I love that. Thank God for the Sinners. That is like my favorite song.
Oh, it's amazing. Like, have you heard Reverse Shark Attack? That like 10-minute long one?
No, you know, the last track, you know, it's like he releases a new record every like 3 months, it seems like. So it's a little hard to keep up. I mean, I feel like actually just as a guy in the band They Might Be Giants, like between a band like Guided by Voices and a band like, and somebody like Ty Siegel, I really have come to understand how exhausting it is to be tracking a band that is truly hyperactive. I got the record that had the song that was like something black. But I forget the title. Something.
Is it I Wear Black?
I Wear Black. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that the one with like the sharks on the cover?
I just have the download of it.
Oh, yeah.
But it's you know, I love his production values. I love how like flipped out those recordings are. I really wonder like what, you know, obviously he works in a very casual way, but there's something sort of extraordinarily extreme about it that's like so interesting to me. Like, it's such an odd combination of like loose and very, like, hitting crazy. It's amazing to me. I totally admire Ty Segall's scene. I don't know much about his contemporaries, and I know a lot of people who track Ty Segall are into other. There's a whole set of bands that are Ty Segall-ish, but I only really know him, and I only know him because I heard that song, that Thank God for the Sinner song, and it just reminded me of all my favorite. You know what it sounds like to me as like somebody who's like old? It reminds me a lot of like glam rock, which is, you know, like a kind of music that, you know, that was like, that was very much like my, you know, teeny bopper music. Like I grew up with like Elton John and David Bowie and these English bands that people don't know, like The Sweet and Gary Glitter and all this stuff. That's really, you know, kind of rompy, stompy, you know, it's just very bawdy kind of, it's dumb music for the most part.
Yeah.
But it's just like, it's like really great. It's just like, you know,
yeah.
And it has saxophone. I mean, you know, glam rock has got saxophones in it, which is really a gas. But yeah, I love Ty Segall.
Yeah, I think
what
he's
else?
Really
what
inspired
else?
By like T-Rex too. Oh, sorry. Like from the 70s era, because he's done a lot of covers of T-Rex. If you're familiar with him, like Mark Bolan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes, I think I can definitely
I bought that. The first T-Rex. Well, I think it was actually the second. It was the first record called T-Rex, the one with what is it? The slider?
Yeah, the slider.
The one,
yeah.
One where, where he's wearing like a bucket on his head. Yeah, I bought that record like when I was 12.
That's awesome.
I love that record. Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah, those are very, very chugly albums. I guess that's why it sort of speaks to me so much, is that it reminds me of a kind of music that, like, there's, you know, rock has been around forever, and there are, like, threads in it that are not really that well remembered now. It's like there's sort of like a cultural amnesia about certain times and trends. And I feel like that glam rock stuff, the essence of it is not really in a lot of rock music these days. There's a lot of punk rock in music, but there's not a lot of glam rock in music anymore.
No, it's disappearing, unfortunately, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they should bring more of that stuff kind of back. And that's also a thing that Ty Segall does a lot, you know? And, like, his newer stuff, he said that you haven't listened to it as much, but he released an album recently. I can't remember what it's called, but, like, the album is black, and it has, like, him and, like, different, like, rainbowy kind of colors on the cover, but, like, that is a little bit more glam rock inspired, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Like, yeah, no, there's not that
wondered,
much of that.
I also wondered, like, from a distance, I, like, wonder, just as a professional musician in 2018, I wonder what track Ty Segall is on. Like, what is he trying to, like, where is he, where do you go if you're Ty Segall? Like, does he play at Bonnaroo? It's like, he seems like he kind of exists entirely outside of the music scene in a certain way. Like, I feel like, you know, it's like you're more likely to, like, you know, see like Tune Yards than you are, you know, pop up on a TV commercial than, like, you know, there's plenty of like bands that are unusual or individual, but it's like Ty Segall is like really kind of off the graph.
He really is. And like, he does a lot of work with other bands, I know, like Useless Eaters. Do you know that band?
No, I don't. You see, that's the thing. I don't know his other projects. You know, I know there's some guy in his band that he also appears on his records, and like they've been tight forever. Also, like, I've seen the couple of videos that I've seen of Ty Segall performing live. It seems like he's playing like these really nuts locations. It's like, oh, let's play on the roof of this parking garage. You know?
Yeah,
it's
definitely.
Like, is that a gig? Like what? You know, I don't know. I'm sort of fascinated by him, but I should probably delve deeper.
Yeah, just like seeing how weird he can push it, you know, and just how
yeah.
much he can kind of shock.
Well, I know for
maybe.
A while he was. Wasn't he doing appearances on, like, didn't he have a couple of reoccurring appearances on like the Letterman show or something, or Conan or something, where he did really weird stuff? I think he did stuff where he like appeared in some kind of crazy costume. Like, he did the entire song in, like, singing with, like, a thing, like, a crazy thing on his head. He was like very, very mental. I don't know.
I haven't
like
heard of
really
that, but I can see
guy.
It happening.
Yeah. He's a cool guy. So you're sort of into like psych rock kind of stuff?
That and like garage rock, I'd say. Like, do you know like Jay Reatard or like Fiddler or Skaters? That's a New York band.
I'm trying to think. I'm thinking of a different band. I realize they don't have a female singer, do they?
No, they don't.
Yeah. I can't remember who that was, but that's cool. I'm a real sucker for sort of like 60s infused stuff, and it's funny because like. You know, in the music business, there's this take on retro rock stuff that there's like a governor on it. Like it only gets so popular because in some ways it's like slightly derivative. And I remember like early on, like our publicist did publicity for the White Stripes before they blew up. Yeah, I mean, well, they were like, you know, they spent a couple of years, like, you know, on the fringe, you know, back when Meg White and Jack White were married, that, you know, like, that was, there was a while when, like, that was actually their peg, was like, you know, that was like, oh, they're, you know, or they were formally married, like, that was like, which is like, oh, how interesting, like, you know, that they were brother and sister.
Oh yeah, didn't they like pretend they were siblings or something, but they were like divorced?
Yes, that they were that they pretended that they were a brother sister act, which you know you could kind of believe because they had matching jet black hair, which is like doesn't make any sense at all. But and also I guess they have like translucent skin. They have equally translucent skin.
That weird uniform they wear, basically. That red.
Yeah. I mean there was something very twinsy about their presentation, so you'd be like, okay, well, maybe they're twins, whatever. You know, they're pale people with dyed hair. And that was like sort of the rap on them initially. Like they were trying to break them as like a big, you know, next big thing act. And what was weird is that because there was something so retro about what they were doing in a way, like there's just a lot of rock critics who just think like, you know, stuff that's retro is just not original enough. Like even if it's like 51% original, there's too much like already kind of old fashionedness about it, you know,
yeah,
in
like
the retro
stuff. Yeah,
it's
overplayed kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. I think like just like, you know, whatever gatekeepers there are left who actually influence what, you know, what people hear and what people don't hear. And I guess there's probably less and less because people can hear everything for themselves. But it's like the old school music critic thing was like retro bands are not original enough.
Yeah.
But you see, I feel like those retro bands, there's a charm to, you know, that garage rock stuff is super charming. And I like rock music, you know, it's like I play the guitar, you know, it's like I love listening to guitar, you know, people freaking out on guitars, you know, it's like it's not like just because people freaked out on guitars in the 60s doesn't mean they can't freak out now.
Like there's something timeless about that, you know, like just experimental,
there's something
like,
very
freaking
timeless.
Out on guitars, like you said.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Ty Siegel is certainly freaking out on his guitar. I love that.
I do too. That is so amazing that you're just like you're into that stuff. I think that's awesome. Like, talking to you about that is really cool. To kind of get into some They Might Be Giants stuff, is there any, like, that kind of stuff that's influenced you guys, like Ty Siegel or other recent musicians that you guys are into?
Well, I think, like, you know, I think the thing, just over the course of, like, our whole career, I think the big sort of mind bender for us was, like, when we did a show with the Pixies really early on, and I think it really kind of, you know, like through the 70s 70s and 80s, there was something about really loud music that seemed, you know, kind of, I mean, with the exception of like the Ramones, who are probably like the loudest band I ever saw.
You saw the Ramones?
You know, I saw the Ramones many times. And then I saw, and there was a band from Boston called Mission of Burma, which was like the absolute loudest band. Like they were so loud, it was really wrong. And like, with the exception of those bands, I never really felt like, you know, the really loud bands were necessarily like that impressive. You know, I liked loud, okay, but like I didn't really get the, like, you know, what was cool about like the super loud thing until we saw the Pixies, and that was really like kind of, there's not, you know, I mean, the weird thing is like we're trying to figure out like what original stuff like we've got going on. Like we're kind of digging into ourselves as much as possible. And, you know, besides like primordial songwriting stuff, which is like, you know, probably, you know, 40% of it's like the Beatles and the rest is just like stuff that we heard on the radio as kids. Like, I feel like it's, you know, the thing about writing songs is that it's a kind of time travel. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you can be just as influenced by like Louis Armstrong as like, you know, some contemporary thing that's on the radio. Like, it's if you're writing original music, it's like, it doesn't really, the dates don't matter.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting that you brought up the Ramones, because I was going to ask you, actually, because you guys started in Brooklyn in the 80s, correct?
Yeah. We were friends in high school. We were friends in high school in Massachusetts in the 70s. Like, I went to high school, like, from 74 to 77, and, like, that last year of high school, you know, I had my driver's license, and we would go in to see a lot of, it was like 1977, so it was like the year of punk rock in New York. Like all the first wave of punk rock bands would drive to Boston and play at the Rat, which was kind of Boston's equivalent. It was in Kenmore Square. It was this little club, very much the Boston equivalent of CBGB. It had a good sound system. It held a couple hundred people. It was not a particularly big place. But, like, all these New York bands, like the Talking Heads and the Ramones, I don't know if the Ramones, were already too big, but, like, Talking Heads played there, like, what were the other bands? Like, a band called Tough Darts, who people don't remember, but, like, Mink DeVille, Père Ubu, all these sort of first wave New York bands, and then The Boston, I don't know if you ever heard of a band called The Real Kids.
Yeah, they're, I have, Boston. Actually. Yeah, I've listened to their album. Yeah. The, like, red cover with the two guys there. Yeah.
Yeah, if you hear a Real Kids, there are a couple of, like, live recordings of them, like, playing at this place called Cantones in Boston. And when you hear, like, the audience of 17 people clapping at the end of the song, like, I'm one of the people. Like, I saw The Real Kids probably, you know, at least a dozen times over the course of a couple of years. And so, like, you know, we were just teenagers kind of kicking around Boston with our fake IDs and, you know, my friend's mom's car. And, you know, we got into these clubs, and it was all super cheap, you know. It was like, and we didn't drink at all. So it was like, it was just like whatever the price of admission was, and that was it. So it was like seeing a movie. But, it was a great time, you know. We saw all these great bands. I mean, Père Ubu was this like really interesting experimental band from Ohio, but they were working out of New York a lot, and so all these New York bands, we thought they were on tour. Like when we saw New York bands play at the Rat, we thought they were doing like a national tour, and they were just going to like whatever other club. But in fact, they were just driving up from New York and doing that one show and driving back. Like, I remember talking to like David Johansen about, it wasn't the New York Dolls, but it was David Johansen. Dollison, which is like just sort of like the after the New York Dolls thing. I saw him in like Washington D.C. At the 930 Club, the original 930 Club in like 78 or whatever. And then I did a festival with him like 10 years ago, and we were in the same like little car service or whatever. And I told him like, you know, I saw you when I was like 18 years old. And he's like, oh yeah, I remember that. Like Robert Quine was in his band, and it was like, oh yeah, like he had never been on a tour bus. He was telling me like he had never been on a tour bus like until like, you know, 10 years ago. Like they always just drove cars, which is like really crazy to me. I mean, I feel like I've spent like half my life on a tour bus now, so.
I mean, that's so cool that you talked to him and that you got to see all those bands and witness that. So didn't they think that seeing those early on had like an influence on like how They Might Be Giants developed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think, you know, I was pretty much on track to be a graphic designer. Well, I'm just realizing the show I saw at the 930 Club, it was David Johansen. It was a double bill. It was David Johansen and Richard Hell.
Oh.
That's where. And Robert Quine was playing with Richard Hell, of course.
It's Johnny Thunders?
But I remember.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if Johnny Thunders was there. I don't think he was. I think Sylvain was there. But I don't. I think Johnny Thunders was somewhere else doing something else. But it was. They were still really late to get on stage. So there was probably some kind of shenanigans going on. But they were pretty rocking. But Richard Hell was great.
Yeah, he's so cool.
They were really smoking band.
Yeah,
he's still alive.
Okay.
He's still alive. He's
yeah.
definitely still kicking. I mean, that whole, you know, the whole new wave punk rock thing was like this huge Amnesty Day for people like me. Like I don't think I would have ever, I would have ever had the nerve to like learn how to play the guitar, because I started really late, and I wasn't particularly like great at it. So it's like the whole idea of like virtuosity was such a non-important part of being in a band. You know, like the whole DIY aesthetic of like punk rock was like, you know, who cares? You know, it's like it doesn't matter. Like if you just do your thing, that's you know, good enough. And so like 78, John was in like a new wave band in Providence, Rhode Island called the Mundanes, and they were like a sort of like a skinny tie power pop kind of band, and they were like very professional. And all this punk rock stuff was happening. I mean, I saw Elvis Costello in London in the summer of 77. Like I saw his first actual professional show. I went because of his name. I bought tickets to a show not knowing the music, but because he had such a weird name. Like that idea to me, it seems almost impossible. Like who goes to a show because somebody's got a weird name?
I did that this summer, actually. I went to a
really?
Couple of
them. Really? Did it work?
It actually was. It's like when I go record shopping, I will, if the album cover is weird or the band's name is really weird, I will get that often if it's cheap, because I'll be like, wait, because so it's weird looking, so it's probably good. And it's usually right. It's interesting, you know, it's that like weird rolling the dice thing.
Yeah, it definitely was a roll of the dice. But like with Elvis, it was an amazing. I mean, I have to be honest with you. Like, I've never witnessed an event that was more of a. It was at a place called the Nashville Room, which was where like a lot of pub rock bands played. Like, which was a whole trend before like new wave really kicked in. Before punk rock really kicked in, it was a little bit shaggier, a little bit more hippie, but. Like, it was such a star. Seeing Elvis Costello play was such a Star Is Born experience. Like, everyone in the room was like, oh, my God. Like, this guy. Because punk rock was brand new. I mean, 2 weeks earlier, you know, the Sex Pistols had released like Pretty Vacant. Like, you know, the Sex Pistols were still a band. So like, so it's not like all the spiky haired original recipe, like, you know, pierced nose, you know, like punk rock stuff was just like on the cover of tabloid newspapers. So that was all current. You know, Malcolm McLaren was still like the manager of the Sex Pistols. Like, all this stuff was just the current stuff. And then to see Elvis Costello come on and play these, you know, he was dressed, you know, pretty much like a punk rocker guy. You know, he's like wearing like, you know, pencil tight jeans and like little leather shoes. And he had a wedding ring, which was like really weird because he's only probably 21 years old. And I remember it made such an impression on me. I'm like, oh my God, like, he's married. How strange. Cause it just wasn't a time that people in general seemed to get married. Like, it was like, this is an era where people lived together for forever. You know, it's just like not an institution that people, it just seemed very out of left field. Strange that that would be the strangest thing of it. But you know, but he was playing these songs that were so powerful and short and interesting and uncool. Like, you know, he was like so, when he was inside the song, he seemed so, so pissed off. And then, you know, the song would end and like the audience would like just erupt in applause. And because it was his first show, like, he couldn't hide the fact that he was like super pleased that he was going over. I mean, there's no particular reason to know that it wasn't like, you know, the show was being advertised as like the latest sensation. He'll blow you away. Elvis Costello, you know, the critic's darling. This was like, here comes Mr. Nobody doing a show that, you know, nobody's going to be even tracking. And everyone in that room was like, that was the best show I've ever seen. That was the most amazing. Like, that guy's more talented than like everybody else.
Do you think it was one of your best ones you ever seen?
Oh, it was amazing. He got four encores.
Really?
He got four encores. It was like, he played a song twice at the end. He played like, I think he played Allison twice. And like, you know, and oh, that's the other thing is that, like, you know, for 30 minutes or so, he like, you know, he's playing his songs. And this is a weird thing. Like 30 minutes into it, the bass player broke a string.
Really?
Bruce Thomas? Is that the bass player or the Pete Thomas? Whichever the guy's the bass player, broke a string. And like, bass players never break strings. Like, you never see a bass player break a string. And like, but like, he had to change it, which was not going to take more than like a minute. So Elvis Costello played an acoustic version of this song, Party Girl, which is kind of like, it's kind of like the junior version of, it's like not quite as good as Allison, but it's like got the same kind of melancholy quality that Allison has. And he had obviously just written it, and I'm sure like it wasn't on the first album or even the second album, because it seems almost like a derivative, like not quite as successful song as Allison. But in the context of the show, where he had just had like, you know, like was like spitting out these like revenge, like I'm going to chop you into cubes kind of hateful songs. And then to have like the band kind of break down and he's like, okay, well, I'll just play you this song. And it's this like beautiful, heartbreaking, sad song. And it was just like, wow, this guy is like so good, you know? And that was just like a knockout thing for me. I think, you know, just as I've always loved songs and I've always loved pop music, but to have like sort of somebody so clearly kind of resuscitate the 2 minute, 3 minute long verse chorus kind of song, pop song like that, you know, in the era of, you know, obviously like the Sex Pistols had like these short, powerful songs and the Ramones were certainly established in people's minds. And there are people from New York doing interesting things like the Talking Heads and Television. But like, you know, Elvis was like, you know, doing like songs in the shape of Blondie, but with like these incredibly adult kind of lyrics, you know, you know, and it was just like great. It was like so original and so, It was totally inspiring. And, like, you know, basically, like, I got home, like, a week or two later and taught myself how to play the guitar.
Oh, because of that? That's super cool. Yeah. So how old were you when you did that then?
I was 17 in 77. Yeah, I mean, I was the perfect age to be completely hypnotized by punk rock, new wave music. I mean, I was...
Yeah, that's around the time when, I mean, earlier than that, but 17 is when I got really, really into punk rock. So, I feel that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's a perfect fit. It's a perfect fit. And, you know, I was just lucky that, you know, I just happened to be in England when...
So how much later than that did you and John Linnell start forming the band then?
Well, John, about 4 months after that, John and I made some recordings. He was a year older than me, so he actually went to UMass and Amherst, and he came back for Christmas break. And I had a tape recorder and was sort of learning how to play the guitar. And so we did like some home recording that, you know, in the winter... You know, something like over like Christmas break of like 78. And then John went to school for another like 6 months in it, you know, out in Western Mass. And then after that, he went to Providence and was in this working band in like the very late 70s. And like the Mundanes, which is his band, they would open for, they were like, Providence, Rhode Island's only like new wave band. So every time a new wave band from somewhere else came through Providence to play, they would get the gig of opening for them. So like, you know, when Squeeze played in Providence, like they'd open for Squeeze, or when the Ramones played in Providence, they'd open for the Ramones or whatever. So like that was his little kind of like rock internship. You know, he was playing a Farfisa organ, and there were like six people in the band, and they were really John Andrews, the guy who was the sort of the band leader of the Mundanes. He was a really good songwriter, very much in the cut, in the mold of like a Elvis Costello, kind of Joe Jackson, like power pop, very power pop. And he now, he's become a big wheel in animation. Like he was the producer of like Beavis and Butthead. He ended up in LA, you know, kind of got out of the rock music thing when it didn't really take off, and ended up doing a lot of stuff for, I wonder if the company that did like Ren and Stimpy. I think he works for that company. I'm not sure. Yeah. So he's had a whole other career beyond Husky Chupo. Is that what it's called? Got a really unusual name, but he's had a whole career in animation beyond music. But that was John's big, like, sort of introduction to, you know, how to be in a band. And like a lot of like musical scenes, like I was John's friend, and everyone agreed that, like, you know, John, you know, had like incredible talent that wasn't really being showcased enough in the in the Mundanes. So They Might Be Giants kind of started as like a baby brother band in a certain way to the Mundanes. Like I don't even know exactly how that manifested itself, but like, I feel like in some ways, like what we did was sort of informed by like what to do and what not to do. Like we just wanted to have fun, basically. Like we didn't want to take it so seriously that we would have to get anywhere.
So did you guys play with them then?
We didn't do shows with them. I mean, John was still in the band. Excuse me, I'm having this cough. Good, I gotta have I'm getting over this cold. No. I mean, John was still in the band, and I don't think they really wanted to hear about it that much. But, like, I guess the truth is, it's like we were just – everything about them was real. You know, like they had a PA. They had, like, a roadie. They got paid. we did not have a PA or a roadie, and we did not get paid. But we just sort of, you know, kicked around Brooklyn and did a lot of shows in the East Village. And, you know, we were working with a drum machine and these pre-recorded tapes that we made. So we were basically a two-man band playing to a drum machine. And so it was very portable. And so, like, you know, we actually got it down to when, you know, at first Sean was playing like a Farfisa organ, which was really heavy. And then when our housemate had an accordion, and we realized that, like, if he just played the accordion, we could have, like, the tape recorder in one hand, the accordion in the other, and then I would have my guitar and my amp, and we could take the subway to gigs. And that was, like, the big innovation of 1984. And we just played a lot of shows, and the East Village scene kind of blew up. And it was a really interesting scene because it wasn't, there was something very sort of antisocial about it. Like, it was a very inside New York kind of, it was very snobby in a way, just to be blunt. Like, the punk rock thing had blown up, like CB's had blown up in the late 70s and had become very, very famous. And a lot of people had become very, very famous from the downtown scene. And the people who were left in the downtown scene in the early 80s, like 83, 84, 85, were all kind of, there was a certain kind of like a big time fatigue. Like nobody wanted to see shows that were like auditions for record companies. So the scene got much weirder, and like the scene that we really came into when we arrived in New York in like 81, 82, the thing that was really happening in downtown New York was this kind of music called No Wave, which is a real asterisk, you know. But I mean, the most successful thing that people know from the No Wave kind of moment is Sonic Youth. But like Sonic Youth, you know, yeah. Sonic Youth are like. You know, if you think of like the continuum between like REM and the B-52s in the world of Athens rock, like Sonic Youth is like the REM of No Wave. I mean, there's so much more there. You know, even though I'm sure most people find Sonic Youth to be completely inaccessible and obtuse, like they were the really normal band compared to like DNA or Lydia Lunch or all these other, I mean, the Contour, there's a great band called James White and the Blacks, but the stuff they did was like just so mental. It was like just really crazy. Like it was like James Brown through some major filter. But that was like the scene that we kind of arrived in, and there were all these bars that just, the whole emphasis was on this very yelly, screamy music and also performance art. So like we just kind of slipped into that scene and then that scene got really popular, you know, like it sort of turned into more of a dance scene and like a drug scene and like a transvestite scene. But it was quite a time, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, kind of about that stuff, I was thinking about your song XTC versus Adam Ant. Like, is that about that kind of thing? And you guys' like kind of interpretation of the scene that you were in, or like, what does that song mean exactly? Does that have anything to do with this?
Those, they're both English. They're both English acts, so it's sort of more about. It was written in a really different time, you know. I guess, you know, living in the 21st century, like everything, there's speaking of time travel, there's everything is available to everybody. Like all music is, you don't have to be like a big record collector or avid music fan to track all this marginal stuff. Like if you've got you know, a good laptop, you can basically, you know, figure out the history of music pretty effortlessly. But like, I guess I was just sort of thinking about how, you know, there was a moment when Adam Ant was incredibly popular in Britain. And, you know, I had friends who were like really into XTC. I liked XTC okay, but I'm not like the biggest XTC fan. Like you might, I think the general assumption is that people make is like the guys and they must, that might be giants, must really love XTC. They're both kind of Beatles influence bands. But the truth is, I loved Adam Ant. I thought Adam Ant was kind of fantastic. And I loved Adam Ant's band, and I just loved his, you know, I mean, just something's just so nuts about what he does. And I don't think like, you know, I feel like, you know, style counts, you know? I mean, there's something, you don't have to be like that. If you're in a rock band, you don't have to be that dignified, you know? You don't have to be authentic. You don't have to pretend you're authentic to be in a rock band. Like, what's authentic about Little Richard? You know, there's, you know, he's an authentic nut, but like, you know, it's not like, you know, anybody's like, oh yes, I love Little Richard. He sings from the heart. You know, it's like, no, he's just Little Richard. He's fantastic. You know, he just does a fantastic thing. And I feel like that was the thing with Adam Ant. It's like, just, you know, enjoy him for what he does, you know. And so I guess the thing is, it's like, well, I mean, the lyric is kind of an explanation of what I was thinking. Like, it's like XTC versus Adam Ant, content versus form. You know, Adam Ant is, you know, it's the shape of his thing. It's like his fashion statement, his stance, he's not telling you his poetry. He's not reading you his diary entry. He's like singing in manifestos. You know, it's like it's a kind of an agitprop kind of music. You know, I mean, that song Ant Music. You know, Ant Music is a just a great song. Ant Music is like a great song.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's something I've wondered about for a long time, is like what that song was about. Because I kind of thought about it like you were saying, like, oh, maybe you guys just really like XTC, or you have friends that do. But that's interesting to hear like what it's actually about. Yeah.
No, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, the final refrain of the song is like, there is no right or wrong. I got nothing against XTC. It's not like, it's sort of interesting to see, like, over time how the popularity of XTC has kind of waxed and waned. I feel like 10 years ago, there was not a band less popular with like pitchfork critics than XTC. Like that, you know, except maybe like Steely Dan, and you know, and now it's all kind of come full circle. Like, I guess there's a good documentary about them, and people are kind of getting back into them. But yeah, they're definitely like, you know, they've got some great songs, but. It's just a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of about your lyrics. I was wondering if I could ask you, so you guys have very conceptual lyrics, and so over time you guys have kind of been written off as kind of a goofy band, and I don't think that at all about you. I've always thought of you as kind of like a read between the lines kind of band. I was wondering if I get your comment and like what you think about people kind of not really interpreting your lyrics that much. And again, that is in absolutely no way supposed to be like a critique of you guys. But I think that I just was wondering like how you feel about people thinking that you guys are more of a goofy kind of band and not a serious band.
Well, you know, I mean, I can understand why. I think, you know, the truth is like, you know, rock music in general is often like very self-serious, and it's also like the domain of like adolescence, you know. I mean, it's not like, you know, I mean, obviously rock is, you know, there are a lot of, you know, older people in rock music now, but, you know, just as a general kind of music, it's not, you know, it's not like, it's just not that important that it be important, you know. I guess the thing is that's trying to step all the way back and kind of wrap my arms around this whole question. Maybe that's a mistake. There's a sense of humor in what we do, but we are definitely songwriters more than comedians. And like, we're making songs that we want to hold up to repeated listening. And that kind of automatically changes the nature of how we approach like recording a song or putting a song together, because it's like, if a song is too over the top, it's not going to really be that durable, you know? But like, the humor in what we're doing is like, it's kind of a natural reflection of who we are as people. Like, we're just not, I don't think we take ourselves so seriously. I think we're also like a little bit shy of, we're a little bit shy about writing about romantic love in an earnest kind of way. Like, it just seemed a little like too much, and we're not like tough guys, and we don't want to like bother pretending to be tough guys. So it's like, in all those things about like rock music that are so self-serious and so like pretentious, you know, there are a lot of different ways to be pretentious, and I'm not saying like we aren't in certain ways pretentious. I mean, I think we actually, you know, we're ambitious about what we're doing, and you know, we're pretty snobby people, but I guess we just want to do something original that was actually interesting, and maybe it might strike some people as a little strange. I certainly am not surprised if people think we're too goofy. We're not that worried about looking cool, which is, you know, for a lot of people, a lot of performers in rock music, like, looking cool is the only thing to be, you know. So like, you know, I get why it would bum people out, you know. If I was in any way insecure, you know, people, when you're a teenager, your record collection, your music tastes define your character, you know. Like, they're like huge signifiers in like who you are as a person, and it says a lot about you, like who you like. And I think, you know, maybe people just don't want to say like, I'm a big goofball, you know. Like, I think it's I could understand why, like, if you were insecure about how you're coming across to people, that you wouldn't want to like culturally align yourself with a band that is as unconcerned about being taken seriously as we are. In terms of reading between the lines of the lyrics, I don't think like our lyrics are necessarily like so profound. I mean, I think they're just rock lyrics, but I think they're interesting, and I think you know, we've figured out like a way to sort of a balancing act with what we're doing that I think is pretty successful. So it's like, I don't know. I'm probably like not even a particularly good judge of it, because I certainly don't spend a lot of time hanging out with people who don't like my band. Yeah. So you know, I mean, I have a very sheltered existence in certain ways, but I hear what you're saying. I mean, I get it. We probably could have, you know, faked it in some other way. Yeah. When we started, I can tell you this. Like, when we did our first show, like, I have very vivid memories of doing our very first show. And it was, you know, to a very small audience. And most of the people in the audience, I did not know. So we did a couple of songs. And because we were playing with tape, like, the tape just went, you know, it just rolled along, like, it didn't stop between songs. So we had to time out the breaks between songs and then just jump in when it started again. So it was kind of like being on a little weird, like, musical slalom ride. And like, we finished one song and people applauded, and it was like a pretty warm response. And then we started doing another song, and like, I could hear people. My main concern before the show was that the people were going to think we were weird, like way too weird, and they just weren't going to like it because we were too obtuse. And then instead, and this has been, you know, probably like a theme that kind of carries over for like many years afterwards, like, I think people just sort of saw us and thought of like, their crazy cousin or something, you know, like they kind of like laughed in this very familiar and perfectly comfortable way. Like they're being entertained, not because they understood whatever they didn't understand didn't matter. You know, it was just like perfectly interesting to them. And they were like, kind of like laughing with us, you know, not laughing at us. And that was like very interesting, but it was also not exactly what I was anticipating. I really thought like our would work a different way.
Yeah. And I really, really hope I didn't offend you at all when I was saying that. Like, I don't think of you guys as a joke band at all.
But oh, not at all, because not at all.
If you look at your Spotify, Weird Al Yankovic is one of, like, the related artists, and I've always thought that was weird, because, like, I don't think of you guys that way at all, and I wanted to know what your take was. Like, he's, like, at the bottom of the list on just, like, your Spotify page, and I've heard kids in high school say that before, and so I was just, like, wondering.
But, you know, a lot of people love Weird Al Yankovic. I mean, he's got a huge audience, so.
Yeah. It's just, like, in my head,
don't worry about me.
This is
not late-breaking news to me. I'm completely aware of this. I mean, you know, the truth is like, you know, I went to art school, you know, like there's no limits to like how pretentious I can think about what we're doing. So.
Yeah, I'm in art school. I understand. I'm a studio arts
major. No offense taken. No offense taken.
Okay. Yeah. So, you guys have really interesting, like, art videos and stuff, and just, like, your posters and everything. Like, how much, like, input do you and the other band members have in the art direction, or is that just, like, someone else takes care of it?
Well, I will take that as a personal compliment, because, you know, I spent a lot, you know, basically, before the band took off, I was working as a graphic designer in New York and, like, worked in publishing and did... You know, did a lot of like, you know, low level stuff, but I also, you know, I ended up working at Condé Nast and did, you know, fairly legit stuff for Random House and a bunch of other publishers. So it's like, I have that weird commercial art background, and I've always like, that would have been, if I hadn't been in a band, I would have been a graphic designer. Like I was basically like professionally trained to be in graphic design. So when like all the challenges of indie rock came along, like this sort of art direction thing task, you know, there was like no limit to like what was possible with like album covers and making and trying to figure out how to make rock videos and all that stuff. And so, you know, I mean, John and I, you know, had the good fortune of kind of like agreeing on sort of making, we were very influenced by this band, The Residents, who were like a faceless band. And it seemed very appealing. It seemed very appealing to us to have like the band have like a really strong graphic, look, but like not be about like our faces. You know, we really, by and large, we don't ever put our pictures on our album covers. And once you make a decision like that, like you're automatically in like the smallest percentile of like rock album covers. Like most album covers are a picture of the person who made the music, you know, and some of them are really iconic and compelling and interesting. And it's a great way to promote your act and have people know who you are and be famous. But it's like, I think, you know, we felt like, we didn't particularly want to be like that famous, you know, like it wasn't important to us that people knew what we looked like. And so it was like, we just didn't put our pictures on our album covers. And I mean, I remember on our very first album, the guy who did the painting, this guy, Rodney Allen Greenblatt, who was like a big East Village artist at the time, who I didn't really know, but I sort of made a cold call and asked him if he would be willing to do our album cover for free, and he said yes. He included a picture of me and John in the thing, and I got really nervous because I sort of thought like, oh my God, like Linnell's gonna flip out, like he's not gonna approve of this. And Rodney even said, like, you know, I can paint you out if you don't feel comfortable with it. And I was like, I guess it's okay, you know. But basically, we don't really show up on the packaging. And I've lost my train of thought here.
Actually, kind of on that, it's weird, but I didn't know what you guys looked like until I was like 12, and I've been listening to you guys for a long time, so it's like, oh, it's just been about like the music and the whole thing for me. Like, I think that's really respectful, though, not doing like your faces and stuff. Yeah, the thing I was asking about was like the art direction in general, like how much of a say you guys have in it.
Oh, right. Well, you know, we've been very lucky, like, in the sort of the second half of our, like, when we first started, we made a bunch of low budget videos with this guy, Adam Bernstein, and kind of set a tone. We shot them on film rather than video at a time when most videos on MTV were shot on video. So they had this very sweaty look, and like our videos had this very kind of Hard Day's Night look, which was kind of smart of Adam to sort of figure that out. Like, he really, you know, we were just shooting like on a Bolex, like we're shooting on a 16mm camera that's like very portable and very cheap and really ubiquitous, or was at the time. And then the end product like looked like $1 million compared to like what you'd get out of like a TV video camera. And sort of the styling of those things, like, the, you know, I would like with typically with those, the first like half dozen videos we did, I would sort of set about, we would kind of grab all the whatever stage backdrops we had and use them in the video, or we would take all the sort of junk store stuff that we had in our apartments and kind of use them as props. So they were very, all that stuff is very personal to us, you know, like it's like kind of our, there's like an aesthetic thing about it that very, very much like who we are. And then once that was kind of established, it was almost like everybody we worked with afterwards like had a very solid idea. There were such clear representations of like kind of our graphic style that, you know, when we would be, you know, talking to new people, like whether they were animators or illustrators or photographers or what, you know, just any kind of creative person, there was like there was like a reference point that you could kind of say like, we don't want to do this. We want to do something like in your style, but we like this kind of thing. We like this kind of thing. Like, you know, when I talk to like, you know, animators or photographers or something, like, I say, like, you know, like we like transparency effects, you know, and like, you know, just as somebody who's like gone to art school, like that's a very, if you're talking to a designer or a photographer or something, that's like an incredibly like useful like thing to be able to say to somebody. Like, it gives them a real, like a lot to jump off. It's a real trampoline for them, you know. It's like, huh, transparency effects. That's like, that's cool. So, and then like in the second half of our career, it's been sort of more the YouTube era, and we've really gotten into working with animators and illustrators and motion graphics people. And that's great because it doesn't have to be about John and John. Like, it's, you know, like, we couldn't, you know, I mean, I guess we could have gotten actors to be in our videos, but it's like when we first started out, we didn't, you know, the only thing we had was like our bodies. So it was like, we just jumped around in our videos, but like, it wasn't like ideal for us. I think it kind of actually made us a little bit nervous because it was that thing where it was like putting our pictures on our album covers, like, and we didn't really want to be that. You know, part of it is like we were very informed by doing the Dial-A-Song project, which was so anonymous. It was very, very, like, nobody knew what we looked like. People didn't even know we were a band. They just thought it was a phone line. So it was, yeah, like,
the Dial-A-Song thing is so cool. Actually, about that, this is a weird question to ask, but I think it was on one of your compilations. You guys had this weird track of this old lady, who I think she accidentally recorded herself. And she was like, they must be giants. What is this, you know? I've always wondered what that was. Like, how would you guys find that recording? If you know what I'm talking about, with the dial song stuff.
Yeah. It's actually a track that has no name. It's number 13 on a CD. But it's this woman named Gloria. It was in an era where, you know, they were like, I mean, there were a lot of different like telephonic things that people don't really do now. The dial song was a phone machine. So, and not that many, and in the beginning, not that many people called it. So, and it was the only phone I had. So I would leave the messages on just, you know, mostly just to hear people like hang up or, you know, sometimes people would be like, that was weird. And then like hang up. But like, it was the beginning of phone machines, but it was also, AT&T had this thing called three-way calling, which was like the original conference call thing, where if you hit like *7 or something, you could then dial a second number on to join the first number. And so what she did is she called Dial a Song with a friend, and they both listened to it together.
Oh, that's and what that was. I thought he was in the room. Okay.
No. They're having a telephone. And so what happened is, like, I had an unlimited incoming message on my phone because people wouldn't, by and large, they would just hang up after 2 seconds. So there was no need to cut it off. So I just had it on, like, you know, just keep on recording, whatever. And so she, you know, the song ended, and then the two of them are just talking to each other. And, you know, what's super crazy is that as long as that message is, and it's like 3 minutes long or something, right?
Yeah.
Like, that is like, that's literally like the first 3 minutes of a 20-minute phone conversation.
Really?
I mean, they get so, yeah, they just get so far off. I mean, they start having a conversation a little bit soon after they stop talking about they must be giants. They start having a conversation about like the person upstairs who's like running a bath like 6 hours a day, and they're wondering why. And it's such a classic New York conversation. It's like, what kind of person runs a bathtub for 6 hours in a day? Like, what are they doing? Like, are they washing their clothes? I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense. It was just this crazy, you know, and the whole conversation is like, it's like a David Mamet monologue. I mean, dialogue. It's like the other guy is just going like, yeah, I don't know, Gloria. Yeah, no. Like he never says anything besides yeah or no for like the entire time. It was just so funny. Yeah, so like basically I came home from work one day and like turned this thing on, like, you know, like a half hour of messages are on the incoming thing. I'm like, oh my God, like did a million people call? And it was like, nope, just one lady and her friend.
You said it's like bonus material on some like upcoming stuff. It'd be so funny.
Oh, I'd have to dig it out of my attic somewhere. Yeah. I know it's up there somewhere.
That's like one of my favorite things ever, that bonus track thing. That woman.
Yeah. No, it's super funny. I mean, it was truly exceptional.
Yeah. I should probably ask some questions about Dial a Song because that's what I do in my show. So first off, I was wondering like kind of how did like Dial a Song get started, because I feel like Wikipedia might not be right, because that's all I know about it really. Is they said that like John Linnell like broke his wrist or something, and then you had your apartment robbed, it said. And then you guys decided to start recording.
That's all true.
It is, okay.
I think the part that's missing in the explanation is the beginning of the sentence, which is we had just started playing out as a band. And we had probably been playing out for like 6 months. And you know, there's this like thing. I mean, I don't know what it's like for local. You know, some bands start at colleges, so like they have a built-in audience that's very loyal and active and big and just kind of expands naturally. But if you're starting in a city, like which is kind of a sort of a steeper uphill climb as a thing, like, you know, I mean, we were in our mid-20s already, right? So, like, we had our day jobs. I had a job and I was, like, finishing my last year in college, but I didn't have, like, a ton of friends, you know, in my senior year of college that were, like, going out to rock. I didn't even tell people I was in a band, actually, when I was going to Pratt, because I'd been in a band in Ohio, and it was like, oh, you're the weirdo guy in the weirdo band. Like, you know, it just sort of undermined my college life. So I certainly didn't, in a place like art school in Brooklyn, I didn't really want people. You would think it would be like the coolest thing in the world, but like, it was a serious school, and so I just kept it a secret. But like, we were kind of taking off as a band. Like, we had done a couple of shows, and whatever friends we had stopped coming to our gigs. But we had strangers who had heard about the band starting to come to gigs. So it was like, oh, like, we might be, like, finding an audience for what we're doing. Like, this is very exciting. Like, this could be great. And because, like, you know, I mean, This is the weird thing that I think, like, it's hard to appreciate enough. It's like, we actually kind of went over from the very beginning. Like, our show actually worked in this way. Like, people were really, I think they were probably just kind of charmed by how left field it was. But, like, it worked. And so, like, I felt like we had this some kind of momentum going for us. And then right at this moment that I moved from one apartment to another, I got broken into, and they stole everything. They stole, like, all my clothes. Everything was in boxes. I'd only been there, like, one night.
Oh, my goodness.
And everything was still in boxes.
Like, everything was. Oh, my gosh.
Like, they stole everything. They stole, like, all my books. They stole all my tapes. They stole everything I had. The only thing they didn't steal was my 4-track tape recorder because it was too heavy. You know, like, you couldn't carry it. It would, like, you would break your back just trying to walk down the stairs with it. So, like, they just left that behind. So, like, they stole my guitar, like, you know, they stole all this stuff. And it was just a drag. And then, like, that very same moment, Linnell, like, broke his wrist. So he couldn't do shows for, like, six months or some really long period of rehabilitation. And so it was like suddenly everything about the band, which was going along kind of great, was fully, like, backburnered, you know. It was like, we can't really go out and do shows. Like, I don't have an amp. I don't have a guitar. We've got to totally, like, regroup here. And so suddenly this Dial-A-Song idea seemed like, maybe it's a way to kind of bridge the gap, you know, and not lose momentum as a band. Like, we'll start this thing and we'll just change the song every day and people can call in and maybe it'll be like, you know, become like a little New York phenomenon. You know, people will be like, hey, have you heard about this thing? Like, there's this weird thing that's happening. You can call this number and hear a song. And suddenly what seemed like a really bad idea seemed like a lot better idea because we had nothing else to do. So it was kind of out of that crummy place that it made sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, nobody else really has done that ever. So it's like, I'm sorry, my voice sounds kind of icky right now. But no, that's like, it's such an interesting, like, innovative thing, if you think about it. Like, you never hear about people doing that. When I've, like, talked about it before, like, Dial-A-Song, people were like, wait, what? You can do that? Like, it's really interesting ideas that you guys
bring up. Well, I mean, but then again, you have to remember, like, I mean, I had multiple conversations with people at record companies and even, you know, not just major label companies, but even indie label companies who were like, why are you giving away the thing that you'd want to be selling? And to a lot of people, there was a lot of, like, sort of, you know, what is the term? Cognitive dissonance, you know, like, you know, the way I thought about it was like, nobody knows who we are. Our songs are definitely not on the radio. Like, we don't, this is about the most, like, low stakes, you know, gambit you could be involved in. But for like people who are like in the business of selling music, they're just like, you guys just look pathetic. You know, like you're doing this thing that makes you look like your music isn't worth anything. And that's, you know, that, I mean, that maybe that's, it's very different. It's hard. I think it's hard in 2018 to really understand how different the music culture was then. Like the music business was a big business. Like it was a, you know, like the entertainment business part of it was like very real. And people, you know, I mean, people understand the idea of like branding now, like what people call branding now. They were very actively involved in, like, they were, you know, they were into making like strong first impressions and kind of selling acts, you know. And I think in some ways, you know, it was probably lucky for us to end up having a couple of years as an indie act, because we didn't have to put up, we didn't have to explain ourselves. But I remember talking to people at Elektra who were just like, I mean, their impression of Dial-A-Song was like, this is the dumbest idea in the world. Like, I mean, there are people at Elektra who want us to not do it. You know, they just want us to stop when we got signed to Elektra, it was, you know, like, I mean, every band goes through like transitional things, but it's like, you know, we were such a quintessentially indie band that it was like, you know, it was like, oh God, is this going to be the moment that this band starts to really, is it all going to go terribly wrong from this point on? And we kept on doing Dial-A-Song at that point, even though I think in some ways we would, you know, we had been doing it for probably at least 5 years at that point. We would have been happy to just like retire it, just to not have another thing to worry about. But I think we were sort of nervous about like losing our cred with our audience. And then meanwhile, like, you know, the label is like, you guys look like, you know, this is like, so, this looks so stupid for us. Like, why don't you just please end it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's good that you didn't. I mean, it was such a, so many like great songs come out of that time period. And like right now, everything that you're still making, like it's, I'm so glad that you guys are still doing it. Like, it's so awesome, and the videos that you guys make every week and everything. Yeah.
I know. Well, I mean, it's, you know, I think for a songwriter to have a challenge, like, you know, it's always good to have a reason to write a song, you know. It's
It definitely
gets us out of bed in the morning.
All right, I don't know how much more time you want to be talking on the phone, but I have a few more questions, if you'd be all right with that.
Well, I'll try to be less verbose.
Oh no, so you're fine. I'll just,
my voice is kind of marching away from this cold anyway. But like, yeah, let's just do like the speed round. Maybe I can be more entertaining and less thoughtful.
All right, here's one. So my friend Michaela is a really big fan of you guys, and she wanted to ask you, what is it? What is one?
This is what, if we, I'm trying to remember, we were up for some award or something, and Linnell, we were like trying to figure out what we should say when we accept the award, and Linnell was saying that he wanted to say to people, when you're getting up to go to the bathroom on an airplane, don't grab the headrest of the seat in front of you. Because there's a person in front of you as well.
I like that answer. That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you guys have any more plans for, like, the Dial-A-Song in the future? I know you guys are going on tour in Australia pretty soon, like, February, I think. But do you guys have any, like, new plans, or They Might Be Giants, that people should be looking for?
Well, officially, it's going to end, you know, at the end of this year. But the truth is, like, I think I'd like to see if we can figure out how to just like keep it going, maybe on either catalog stuff, or like, you know, fold in songs from the vaults, or do something to kind of feed it. Like, treat, you know, the truth is, like, when Dial-A-Song was in my house as a phone machine, like, it was just like, it was like feeding a fish. Like, I had a suitcase full of like 40 or 50 cassettes, and you know, some of them had been recorded like a couple of years earlier, and I would just put it in for a day, and then I'd change it and put in another one, and there'd always be new songs coming in, but it wasn't like there wasn't even remotely a new song every week. Like doing these Dial-A-Song years, like 2018 and 2015, where we're putting out a new song every week, it's really a lot of work. I mean, it's also, and they're not demos, you know, they're full blown recordings. So, either like maybe we could like figure out a way to do stuff that's like more like sketchy, but I don't know if that would work. Like, you know, with social media, like, you know, the comments are going to be like, you put out like some, you know, casually done thing, people are like, have these guys lost it? Like, I don't know. You know, it's like, it's hard to know how to do it. I'd like to kind of keep the conversation going with all like the people on the Dial-A-Song radio network and stuff. But anyway, no official plan. We're a little bit toasty. So, but we're going to keep going one way or the other.
All right. Here's another one. I was wondering, what is like your favorite album that you've worked on for They Might Be Giants?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I really liked the way Join Us came out. I feel like it's a really interesting set of songs, and it was a real struggle to get it off the ground when we started. And I'm not really, I feel like we were trying to sort of find where we would be after we had done a lot of kids albums, and which, you know, those were creative writing experiments in their own way, but I think we needed to sort of figure out how to crack the code as like a full-on like rock project, you know. Once we kind of got out of the gravitational pull of the kids stuff, you know, some of it is like a little bit more pastiche, you know, like it's like, which is fun to do, and it doesn't really matter because kids aren't really like, you know, kids are the opposite of rock critics. Like, they're not really thinking about like musical influences or things like that, you know? So it's like, it's very easy to just kind of keep it light. But I think I like Join Us. I think Join Us is my favorite of the most recent stuff.
Yeah, and like, I'm sorry, my voice is getting gross again. I'm kind of getting sick too. But I think your kids' albums are actually really well done. Like, I grew up listening to No, and that was like a big influence on me, like getting into music and stuff. And like, Here Comes Science and stuff. Like, I think that they're really well done. And I was kind of wondering, like, So No came out in 2002, I think. Have you guys like changed a lot since then, do you think? Like, has the kids' albums like influenced your sound, or not really that much?
Well, a lot of things have happened, you know, like we've had a lot of different kind of creative challenges. One of the things that was happening while we were doing No was that we were doing incidental music for TV, which is like a really weird job because like you need to work really, really fast. Like I think most people who do incidental music for TV are like sort of your classic kind of I can play anything keyboard wizard kind of people, you know, and they just like can kind of improv and riff their way through the whatever task is at hand. The kid stuff, it's sort of like a you know, it's like there's a good side and there's a bad side to it. Like, we ended up, I think No was a really, really solid record. No was done for like everything about No, like, really still appeals to me because it's not educational. Like, it doesn't have any educational veneer to it, which I think is kind of a fresh breeze. I mean, the truth is doing the following three records that all have themes, it's really easy to write to a theme, and when a theme is like as wide open as like the ABCs, if you're a songwriter, like, you know, writing a song about language and writing a song about words, like there's no easier assignment than that. But still, it's but it, still, it's an assignment, you know? So it's like you're kind of writing, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, it's just, you have, there are different ways to approach it. I can't say it's like necessarily better or worse. I mean, there are plenty of people who write musicals who are just like trying to figure out how to write for the show that they're writing for, and that's a perfectly valid way to write a song. I don't know. But but the spirit of no to me is like, there's something really great about it. I feel like, you know, it's like it really played into our contrarian impulses.
Yeah, I have so many memories with that album because that's like one of the ones that my parents would play in the car when I was a kid and everything. And like, I am almost 20 now, and I still will listen to that album. Like, there's just something about it, like Faber Island and like John Lee Super Taster. It's a really interesting song. Like those are like,
they
could be like regular album songs, I think, just from the way that they're done. It's a really good album.
You know, John Lee, do you ever see that show Wundershowzen?
No, I have not.
Oh, it was on, I think it was on MTV or maybe Cartoon Network. Oh, John, it's actually about a real person. It's about this guy I know who is an actual super taster. It's a true story.
So what does that mean exactly? He's like a super taster, like from his like point of view, I guess, when he said.
Well, basically, like between the age of like 0 and 5, you lose about half your taste buds. Your half your taste buds become kind of just like numb to like desensitized, and I think it's basically an evolutionary. It's an evolutionary trait. I mean, this is my best understanding. I will speak super authoritatively about something I don't really know everything about, just to pretend that I know what I'm talking about. But like, from what I hear, basically, like, you know, to stop infants from like eating dirt, they like little babies, little kids, have all these extra taste buds to make them hate the flavor of anything but like milk and things that are incredibly sweet.
Yeah.
Like, so it's like a way to protect kids from accidentally eating stuff that isn't food, you know, or isn't age appropriate food. So like when they taste like bitter, you know, bitter vegetables like broccoli or, you know, any kind of, you know, dark green vegetables or things that people, you know, picky eaters don't like to eat, like they won't eat it. They, you know, little kids won't eat that kind of stuff because it's just like too much flavor for them. But then your taste buds fall away, or your sensations fall back, and all of a sudden you can eat spicy food and you can eat dark green vegetables, and you can, you know, because you're not in danger of accidentally eating dirt. You know, it's like you're smart enough and you're older. But for a small number of people in the population, they don't lose those taste buds. And those people are referred to as super tasters.
Huh. That's interesting.
They're also referred to as picky eaters, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, because basically you've got the palate of like a 4-year-old.
Like, I always wondered what that was, and like if that was like a made up story or something, because you guys use a lot of narrative in your songs, which I really like.
Yeah,
so no, I was like, is that like a fake friend?
Yeah, I know this guy named John Lee, and he's a super taster, and he will not eat anything. You know, he's a grown man, but he won't eat anything like, he'll eat apple pie. You know, he eats apple pie and like hot dogs. He eats like a child. Nope. No coffee for John Lee.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. I feel like that's kind of it. I have this long list of questions, and we went through a lot of it. Was there anything that you were hoping to talk about that I didn't bring up?
I've talked about so many things I wasn't expecting to talk about. I mean, you know, Ty Segall to start with, and then it just went from there. No, it's always fun to have a conversation that's just like, not like a regular conversation.
Yeah.
So thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. Oh my god,
this is a blast. Let's do this again.
Yeah, it's been so great talking to you. Also, like, thank you to you and John Linnell just for everything you've done for me. Like, you don't know me, but you've influenced me so much growing up, and morally and artistically and musically, and just, like, thank you in general. You guys are some of my heroes. That sounds weird, but it's true. Yeah.
Well, that's incredibly kind of you to say that. You know, it's like, that's very heartening. I appreciate it.
I was worried that would sound like really creepy or something, but that's good.
No, just the opposite. It's very flattering. So you know, I mean, it's like, it's great. You know, I've done, you know, two interviews today with people who, like, you know, grew up with No. It's like, it's wild.
Yeah.
It's wild. So, well, keep on rocking, and I look forward to hearing your show. Can you send the people in the office a link to this so I can post it?
Definitely. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Great.
All right. Have a nice day.
Of course. You too. See you later. Bye-bye.
See ya.